it, you get to the same place. There is no indication that the parties intend or expect punitive damages as if they're over.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rich. Mr. Lombardo?
What I'd like to do is just very briefly talk about the compensatory damages portion of the award. There was some discussion about standard of review, and I just want to make clear that the standard of review in the circuit, I think, is extremely clear in regard to motions to vacate an award. Up until very recently, the standard for review was exclusively to be found in Section 10 of the Federal Arbitration Act. This court basically said that we are not going to look at extra statutory rationales for overturning an award if it's not if there's been no illegality or corruption or incompleteness in regard to the arbitration award. Then this court will not review the soundness of the award. Now, recently what happened was that the case, I think it was cited by appellant, Health Services, discussed the adoption of the manifest disregard of the law standard as an extra statutory basis for overturning an award. But I just want to read what this standard is. This court will vacate an award only where there is something beyond and different than mere error in the law or failure on the part of the arbitrator to understand and apply the law. It must demonstrate that the majority of the arbitrators deliberately disregarded what they knew to be the law in order to reach the results. So, in essence, the standard for the manifest disregard of the law is that the arbitrator must understand the law and deliberately disregard it. There's been no showing whatsoever in the compensatory portion of the damages that the arbitrators did not fully consider the issues that have been raised, including the policies issues that were raised by appellant here. In fact, these issues were fully briefed, fully discussed. The central question that was before the arbitrators was whether or not an absolute privilege applied to these communications to the NASD. And under Illinois law, which did apply substantively, that question depends on whether or not the NASD was functioning in a quasi-judicial capacity. And clearly the arbitrators held that it was not. And what those communications enjoyed was a qualified privilege that could be overcome by a showing of wanton or malicious conduct. And it's on that basis, presumably, that they awarded the compensatory damages. In fact, they specifically mentioned this wanton and malicious conduct in their award. So,
which brings me to the broader review of an arbitrator's award that overrode a privilege.
I'm sorry, excuse me?
Don't you think there would be broader review of an arbitrator's award that overrode a privilege? These privileges serve, you know, larger public purposes. I mean, suppose the arbitrators decided they wouldn't recognize the attorney-client privilege in an arbitration. Wouldn't that be problematic?
I think what you've got here is, I think that if Illinois law had a clear position on whether a self-regulatory organization like the NASD, that communications to such an organization were absolute privilege, and the arbitrators ignored that, then I think that would be exceeding their powers. They would be disregarding the law. I think in this case what you had was no law on point in terms of Illinois. Essentially, the only cases that were cited by appellants were cases that involved governmental bodies. The closest thing to a non-governmental body was the Attorney Disciplinary Committee that was set up by the state Supreme Court. So you essentially did not have any clear understanding as to whether the an absolute privilege applied or not. There wasn't clear precedent for applying it to a non-governmental body, and I think on that basis, the arbitrator's decision was fully mandated and justified by the facts of the case. And that brings me, I think, to the only issue that's properly before the court here today, and that is the issue of punitive damages. Were the arbitrators in this case empowered to award punitive damages? Now, I want to just highlight the disagreement that we have with appellants. I think both parties agree that the arbitrator's powers flow exclusively from the party's intentions. That was the intent of Congress in passing the Federal Arbitration Act. And those parties' intentions are manifest in the arbitration agreement. Both parties, I think, also agree that if the arbitration agreement had explicitly stated that punitive damages are not allowed, then that would be binding on the arbitrators, and if they awarded punitive damages, they would be exceeding their powers. Conversely, I think both parties would also agree that if it stated expressly that punitive damages were allowed, that, again, the arbitrators would be bound. Finally, I think in the case of Mastrobon...
If you have a suit that rests where federal jurisdiction is based on diversity, then wouldn't there be a serious Erie problem if federal common law were used to define the remedial powers of the arbitrator? Because, you know, remedies are considered substantive for Erie purposes.
I think this question has already been answered, Your Honor, both by the Supreme Court and by the Circuit. In Commonwealth Edison versus Gulf Oil, this very issue came up. A plaintiff came in and stated that they should be bound in terms of deciding the scope and extent of the arbitration, that they should be bound, that the governing law should be state law. And they provided two bases for that. One was a choice of law provision that was contained in the arbitration contract. The other basis was diversity, the argument that essentially is being presented by appellants here. And this circuit rejected both arguments. And the reason was that the right to enforce an arbitration agreement is a right conferred by Congress. It's a federal right. And the interpretation of that agreement as to whether this claim, that in this case Mr. Barabati has brought forth, can or cannot be arbitrated, is an issue that implicates federal rights. And on that basis, it is an issue of federal law. That's the essence of the holding in Moses H. Cohn, and that's the essence of the subsequent holdings both in the Supreme Court and the Circuit. So the issue in this case really has to do with how do we interpret an arbitration clause? How do we interpret the party's intentions where parties' intentions are essentially silent? Unlike Mastrobuono, this case contained no choice of law provision. This court recently ruled that given the choice of law provision, that evidences party intent to be governed by state law. That was the essence of the holding. And in that sense, it was following the Supreme Court holding in Volt, in which the Supreme Court held that a California court's finding that a party had intended to be bound by its choice of law provision, because of a choice of law provision, it was intended to bind itself to state law, was perfectly acceptable. But in both Volt and in this court's case in Mastrobuono, there was no question that the interpretation of that intent was federal common law. That's the essence of Moses H. Cohn. Essentially what it says is that how we interpret this contract, whether it's contract construction, whether there's issues of waiver, et cetera, those are going to be governed by federal law. Once we've determined what that intent is, then if we determine that because of a choice of law provision, the parties intend to be bound by state law, we are willing to apply that law because the Federal Arbitration Act calls for living up to the intentions of the party, or vindicating the intentions of the party. So the real question then is, looking at this broadly worded arbitration agreement that doesn't have a choice of law provision and doesn't state one way or the other whether punitive damages are allowed, the question is, what does federal common law call for? How should the federal courts...
The federal common law that is involved in cases like Moses Crowe and so on, isn't this just dealing with issues of arbitrability?
Well, I think that's...
Because if you have a diversity case, you can imagine Title IX as creating some procedural adjunct to federal court diversity suits. Try to relieve the workload of the federal courts. But whether to allow punitive damages seems quite remote from just providing a form. Well, what if you had a state that absolutely forbade the award of punitive damages in any case?
Well,
if the parties sign an arbitration agreement, even though the only basis of federal jurisdiction is diversity, they can have punitive damages.
It's an interesting question.
A theory type of result.
I'm not sure that would be true. If a state barred punitive damages of any sort, both in court and in arbitration forms, and the governing law was state law, either through a choice of law provision or even through diversity, then I think there would be an interesting question as to whether or not punitive damages were allowed. But that's not the situation here. That was the situation in Fallenstock, and that was the situation in Mastrobono, where they where essentially punitive damages were barred in arbitration cases. Here, there's no Illinois policy that says that punitive damages are barred in court. There's no policy that says that punitive damages are barred even in arbitrations. And the only issue here is whether or not to apply a state law rule of construction. I think the notion that we can separate out the issue of enforceability from the issue of remedy undermines the Federal Arbitration Act. When we talk about a claim or a controversy, we're not simply talking about the issues involved, we're also talking about what remedies are available. You can't separate those two things out. If we say to a jury that you have a right to a jury, but if you go to a jury, then you are only going to have $5,000 in damage cap, that you can't exceed that cap. Whereas if you go before a judge, you can get the full amount of relief that you're asking for. Clearly the right to this alternative form has been undermined. And let me point out that...
Excuse me.
Sure, go ahead.
You refer to this as the question of whether a state rule of construction should apply, and I assume you're referring to the Illinois right networks in Edwards. But isn't it more than that? Isn't that rule a question of the authority of the arbitrator to make that award, that unless there is an explicit agreement, the arbitrator has no such authority?
Well, it is a way of... I think both Edwards and all the cases agree that the issue is the party's intentions, and how do we interpret the party's intentions. So what I mean to say is that the rule is basically a rule of construction for an arbitration agreement like this, which is silent.
But without that expressed intention, they don't confer to the arbitrator the authority to act on that subject.
Under Illinois law, that's correct. I think the point that I'm trying to make is that first of all, we don't think that the parties' evidence and intention to be bound by state law. So the question is, what's the best policy under federal law? And I think the question of whether federal law should presume or not presume punitive damages has to be looked at in light of congressional intent to encourage and favor arbitration. Now, as the Supreme Court noted in Volt...
But you've got a kind of funny reverse preemption, because you're suggesting that there's a federal common law that likes punitive damages, but it could be preempted by a of state law which said no punitive damages.
I don't think that I'm saying that there's a federal law that likes punitive damages. I think what I'm saying is that there's a federal law that likes the notion that the same remedies that would be available in court are going to be available in arbitration. That essentially the Federal Arbitration Act was, as the Supreme Court stated in Fold, the Federal Arbitration Act was passed because Congress...
So you're saying that if a state allows judges or juries to award punitive damages, it cannot prevent an arbitrator who exercises authority under Title IX from awarding
it's not the
non-discrimination principle.
I think it's a question of what kind of default rule is set up. I don't think that it's a matter of the state not being able to prevent it. I think that the question is how should the federal court interpret this contract initially, the party's intentions. The state certainly has a right to do whatever it wants in regard to its state arbitration rules. Right? But the whole purpose of the Federal Arbitration Act was to reverse a traditional hostility towards arbitration. State legislatures, state courts, federal courts, all have this notion that, as the Supreme Court stated in Gilmer, a general suspicion that arbitration was weakening the protections afforded substantive law, that the substantive law afforded to would-be complainants. And so they would say that arbitration agreements were unconscionable or arbitration agreements were illegal. And essentially, the Federal Arbitration Act put a stop to this bias. What it says is, you've got a right to contract, you have a right to choose this alternative form. If you so decide. Now, you may not decide to do that, but if you want to use this alternative form, then you can resolve your dispute on the same basis in this form as you would in court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to both. I think your time had expired, Mr. Chappelle. So we thank both parties, both the council, for a very good argument.